Where did you guys buy your musical equipment?
Most of it through B Sharp.
What do you recall about Jim Lopez, the owner of B Sharp Music?
A character not unlike Jack Parr.
Okay. Explain a little bit, please.
He was iconic, sardonic. He was just an incredible character. And it's funny, Jim either liked you, sadly I don't think I ever fell into that category, or he just didn't like you. But from juxtaposed to that, I don't think there's very many people that didn't like him, because he was just such a character and a caricature of a character.
Okay. Do you remember any stories about him?
None that I'm going to be allowed to repeat.
That's fine. So we're up to your third 45, another Lonnie Mack song, Wherever There's a Will, There's a Way. What's the story behind that song?
Just a great song. I mean, the lyrics, the chords, there was nothing about that song that was inherently not terrific. Once you heard it, you just knew, oh man, this is stellar. And that's why we decided, yeah, we got to do this.
Now, the story I've heard is when you originally went in to record this, you simply recorded a portion of the song. Is that correct? Not the whole song?
We had only heard it once, and none of us could remember the verses. So we went in and did 10 choruses in a row and released it thinking, well, the choruses should be able to stand by themselves.
And the B-side, Howlin' for My Baby, was a cover song as well, correct?
Oh, great song. And that's where we had Mojo Buford on harp. And at that point in time, he was still Muddy Waters' harp player. And, that was just a fun song to do.
And had you heard the original version by Willie Dixon?
I'm not sure if we had or not.
Okay. So your third 45 now comes out, also on Banger. Wherever There's a Will, There's a Way. And what happens with this record?
Again, gets airplay, affects our price, affects our drawing capability going into venues. And the band continues to succeed.
Okay, so your third record's out, you're popular, you're playing around town. Were there certain bands you hung out with and socialized with after playing a job?
Very much so. There was a place downtown next to the World Theater called, I believe it was called, it's an Italian name. I want to say Vecchio's, but it wasn't. The Venetian Cafe. And we would all meet there. Almost all the bands that were working locally would meet there, you know, 1:30 in the morning, get together. And one of the premier bands in terms of talent at that time was a group called the Dorados, with Gary Nielsen, Tommy Seacrest, Don Dax, and Joel Hyatt. And Nielsen went on to have a band called Blue Ridge or Blue Rock, and I brought you the album, which later went on to become the Nielsen White Band, which later got a contract with Warner Brothers, but did not pursue it because of some of the management criteria that was required. But they were probably the best musicians in town at that time, in I would say 63, 64, 65, without a doubt, just incredible players, individually on their own instruments, but also as a band that just played together. It was like a marriage with good sex.
And were there certain bands in particular that the Accents would hang out with?
Oh, all of the top three. I just need to make a correction here. What I thought was the Venetian Cafe was actually called the Venice Cafe, next door to the World Theater, which is, by the way, where Bill Deal would often have all of the local players that ate at that restaurant come in for private screenings of movies that were coming out up in the loft, as it were, or balcony. Yeah, just he was incredible to all the bands, the way he treated them, gave them special priority, and yeah, terrific guy, Bill Deal, WDGY.
Did that include Laurel and Hardy movies?
Oh, Bill is to this day, what can we say, a founding, a charter member of Sons of the Desert. I believe that's the correct name for the Laurel and Hardy thing. Oh, yes, he just thoroughly adored them.
So you guys would go down there and watch Laurel and Hardy movies afterwards?
It was where we first got turned on to Peter Sellers, who was an incredible British comedian. Unfortunately, somewhat of a nutcase. Yeah, I mean, the movies that he was coming out with no doubt impacted me as much as Jonathan Winters or Bob Newhart or any of the great comedic, again, Jack Parr crosses my mind, the great comedic professors of that time.
Okay, I'm looking at a list of your records here. It looks like Why and Roadrunner, your first 45 on Banger, was re-released on the Garrett label. And then I believe you went back in and redid Wherever There's a Will. Is that correct?
We actually got a chance to hear the record and write down the words to the verses. So now we had a product that was, shall we say, more complete than just the hairdo on top. We actually could put a face to it.
So Wherever There's a Will is now re-recorded and re-released with the complete version. Now, is this version again played on the radio?
Oh, yes.
So you actually had two versions of the same song?
Not playing simultaneously.
Right.
They were probably separated by almost a year.
Okay, and again, looking at my notes here, there's another recording of Wherever There's a Will that comes out, and this has a different B-side. What was on that B-side?
A song called Louisiana Man.
That's a cover song, I presume?
I have no idea.
I believe that's Doug Kershaw. Did Louisiana Man get played?
Think it probably did, but
The Accents put out a song on Twin Town, The Muffin Man. How did that come about?
Oh, that actually was intended to be a B-side. The other song, Someone to Love, was our intended A song. But it was a critical time for the band in the sense that both Kenny and I were being drafted, as was Tom. And it was the beginning of the Vietnam era. And things were very, there was a cacophony of trying to figure out what in the heck are we all going to do if we wind up getting drafted. So it was, I would almost have to say it was a last-ditch effort at getting something on the radio and trying to capitalize on those last moments of our fleeting stardom.
So you actually wanted Someone to Love to be the A-side?
Yes.
And that was an original, and who wrote that?
Kenny and Tom, guitar player and drummer.
Whose idea was it to put out Muffin Man as the A-side?
I am really saddened to bring this up, but I think actually it might have been mine, almost in jest, as to we just need a B-side. And back then, records were produced with an A-side. It was the only side that was meant to get played. The only reason you put another song on there is because the record had two darn sides. And you had to put something on there. And I said, well, how about this piece of junk?
It's kind of a novelty song.
Novelty would be pressing it a little bit.
What happens? Is it played on the radio?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But by then we were in the twilight of our current popularity. And again, we all knew you were going to Vietnam or college or getting married. So anything to get out of Vietnam worked.
And that turns out to be the final 45 for the Accents, it appears?
That was it.
In 1965. So at what time period does the original version of the band come to a conclusion?
Having started back in 63 in my parents' living room, it was about 2 years later that we had pretty much exhausted our resources with recording potential. We were all looking at military service or some other alternative, albeit getting married at that time was an exclusion from military service or going to college. Tom and I and Kenny were the first three to be called up, and we just decided, you know, we're going to just pull the plug at this point, figure out what we're going to do next. So it was with tremendous regret and sadness that we had to close the door on something that for all of us had been something that had all the beauty of a Stephen King novel, but ended inappropriately in the middle of the novel with no real decisive ending other than recognition that there just was nowhere else to go with this.
What was the impact of the Beatles' popularity starting in February 64 on the local bands in town here?
That was incredible. We would literally stay at my house 3 to 5 days a week with every new Beatles album that came out. And Tom would just insist that we get it right. And we all wanted to get it right. I mean, every harmony note, every nuance of musical parts that were played. And we would literally almost come to tears trying to get some of these songs down. We were very lucky in that Ray Callahan, Big Reggie, who owned a place called Reggie's Dance Land in Excelsior, decided to bring the Beatles in, and he brought three local bands on board to play in the mezzanine level as an opening while the 3,000 people were coming in. We were lucky enough to be selected as one of those bands, and very stellar time for all of us, because it was the most unique part of music. Everything prior to that had been pretty much 3 chords, 5 chords, 4 chords, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, and all of a sudden the Beatles come along and they develop whole new chording systems and adding 6, 7, 8, 10 chords to a song, doing things vocally that were just unheard of at that time. It was truly a magic time, and they were a magic band. For us as musicians, that was like discovering cooking for the first time, that you could make something besides a hamburger or a hot dog. It really played a huge role in the development of all the guys in that band and how they developed after that as performers, artists, players, and in some cases even people with regard to their attitude.
I assume that the bands Reggie hired to play that night, in addition to you, would have been the Underbeats and Gregory Dean Leavani's, the big three, right?
Correct.
Okay. What did you think of the Beatles live?
It's, what did you think of Sophia Loren the first time? You know, I mean, imagine seeing her live. No matter what your expectations or disappointments might have been, there's no way in the world that you could not be impressed, affected, infected, and effected. It was magic time.
I'm kind of curious as to the different personalities on stage of the four members of the Accents. Could you kind of run through how that worked on stage as far as like the chemistry or the different roles people played or different personalities?
I had a chance, speaking of interaction of personalities and more importantly, sensitive humor. Nystrom and Sand and I existed much like Tim Conway and Harvey Korman. Our sole purpose was to crack each other up. Skip had a great sense of humor, but it wasn't a big focal point for him. Whereas the three of us rejoiced no more or at no higher a level than when we had reduced each other to the point of tears, where we literally couldn't deliver a comeback line, a response of any kind. And it was one of the most joyous parts of my life.
This is on stage, right?
On stage, yes. Yeah, that was the idea. Break the other guy up to the point where he can't talk. Because then you get a shot to go in and attack again.
Did the audience like this?
Oh, loved it. It's like watching a good war movie with fighter pilots. The more often you can shoot down a zero, the better. I mean, it was just heaven.
Is there a particular memory of your time with the Accents that sticks out as something special?
The entire experience. We were very lucky in the sense that even though we were developing egos, they hadn't quite developed yet. So we were at, shall we say, the threshold of that attitude. And we just thoroughly enjoyed working off each other. And occasions, Freudian slip there, walking on each other. It was almost like there were no rules. There were no guidelines. There were no boundaries. If it works, if it gets a laugh, nobody felt threatened by it. And everyone just thoroughly ate it up and loved it, both within the band and outside of the band, I would perceive in most cases.
The preceding interview was recorded on September 1st, 2012, at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota, and was produced by Danny Johnson and Tom Campbell. The copyright owner of this interview is MiniPawMusic.com.